and I am here to do the devil's work.
Welcome to another episode of the Carnal Extremities podcast, a horror podcast where we take a extreme or somewhat extreme offering and pair it up with a extreme or somewhat extreme musical offering. You know the rules here. The term quote-unquote extreme is always played very loose, very fast, very loose, like, you know, anything that elicits a visceral reaction from somebody. As always, I am one of your hosts, Reina Cervantes, and joining me is...
I am your other host, Vanna Taylor.
We're back for another one. I don't know why I say that, like, we're coming back, like, every time, like we're coming back from a break every single time, because we're not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It you never know when someone will be back.
Speaking of that, guess who is back?
We have another beautiful guest with us today.
Joining us this week, you may have heard her voice before on this pod. It's Maddie from the Slasher Girls podcast.
Hey, hey. What's up, everybody? Sorry, that was such a bad intro. Hi, guys. I'm so excited to be back.
I thought you were going to do, like, the Fat Albert introduction of, like, hey, hey, hey.
So sorry. I don't know what possessed me in that moment.
Possessed? Wow. I don't know how to segue from that. I thought I had something, but thank you for joining us again this week. Our Exorcist episodes were really fun.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me again. I absolutely loved recording The Exorcist, Immaculate with you guys. I'm super pumped to be back.
Yeah, I'm really loving this little religious horror like stint we got going. It's just fun. I mean, you know, it was just Easter too. It's like spring. I feel like it's the season for talking religious horror.
Yeah, it's Hot Priest Month apparently.
We can't do Hot Priest Month and not cover the Exorcist TV series eventually.
You're so right.
I mean, also like Midnight Mass, you know.
Oh.
Oh my God.
Okay. Let's start just naming stuff we know that has a hot priest. There's obviously Fleabag.
Yeah.
The Exorcist TV series, Midnight Mass. We got... Is there something else with a hot priest that I'm not thinking of right now? Or is that the Holy Trinity of it all?
I don't know. I guess I feel like I'm not, maybe I'm not well versed in film priests.
I'm trying to think. It's gotta be something else. Do you know anything, Madison? Or do we?
I'm trying so hard to think. I feel like there has to be so many more hot priests that I'm just missing right now.
It's oh. It's well, he's not a priest. He's more of a preacher. What that movie that Netflix did, Devil All the Time with Robert Pattinson and Tom Holland.
Oh my God.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I gotta clear the room on something because I just said preacher and this reminded me of this. So forgive my little tangent right here. Why the fuck are they remaking Night of the Hunter?
I don't know. I don't have answers for you.
Have y'all seen the original one?
No.
I've seen like the one from the 50s?
Yes.
Yeah. They're remaking it? I didn't even know about that.
Yeah, it was just announced, and I don't really like the creative team behind it. It's the creative team behind the Black Phone remaking it.
Oh my God. Oh, so is it a Universal project?
I assume. Most of that creative team's output is Universal, so I would assume that Universal's redoing it. I don't know who owns the rights to that movie, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because, well, the Criterion for the original came out recently, and it was done more in collaboration with, like, UCLA, the film archive. Oh,
that's really cool, though.
That is a very good Criterion. That is probably one of my favorite Criterion releases, like, ever.
Damn. It's well, fantastic. That's weird that they're remaking it. Hopefully it goes well.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that, like, you watch it and it's like, and it's genuinely so perfect. You're like, who in their right mind would ever do this? And the writer of the movie proceeded to get on social media and was like, you know, the book is crazier than the movie, than the 1950s one allowed. And I was like, oh, shut up. Oh my dude. God.
The one thing I like about remakes, whether they're good or bad, is I feel like they'll always bring an audience to the original that, like, wasn't there before. So maybe a bunch of Zoomers are going to hear about the original for the first time and watch it now, which is kind of cool, you know?
That's funny you mentioned that, because the movie we're covering today was remade in hopes of reaching a new audience back in 2006.
Oh my God, I was so sorry. I won't get into me in 2006 about this movie until later. Sorry.
You're good. You're good. Should I continue?
Continue. I'm so sorry. I got too pumped.
Okay. As you can tell, we're very enthusiastic about this film we're covering today. We're covering The Omen from 1976, not 2006. This version was directed by Richard Donner and written by David Seltzer. It stars Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, David Warner, and Billy Whitelaw. The film's plot follows Damien Thorne, a young child replaced at birth by his father, unbeknownst to his wife, after their biological child dies shortly after birth. As a series of mysterious events and violent deaths occur around the family and Damien and his childhood, they come to learn he is in fact the prophesied Antichrist.
For generations, the Thornes have been a family of tremendous wealth, position, and power. The perfect marriage of Ambassador Robert Thorne and his wife Catherine was fulfilled by the birth of their son, Damien. And then, when the child was 5 years old, something terrible happened. And then, it happened again. Was it an accident? Was it murder? Was it a coincidence? Or was it an omen?
Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
20th Century Fox presents a film of psychological suspense about an occurrence of earth-shaking importance. Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, The Omen.
I was at the hospital, Mr. Thorne, the night your son was born. I saw its mother. I saw its mother.
I have fears. I have fears.
What kind of fears?
Its mother, Mr. Thorne.
You saw my wife.
Its mother.
What is it you're trying to say?
His mother was a...
This is not a human child. Make no mistake.
There are those who will die for him. There are those who will kill for him. Who is he? What does he want? Where did he come from? And can he be stopped? Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, The Omen. If this is the truth, where does it end?
Okay, who wants to start the conversation on The Omen?
That's a good question. This is another one that I probably didn't watch until maybe middle school. So I don't know if either of you have, like, earlier memories of The Omen or, like, a strong connection with it.
My connection is, it might be Madison's connection. I saw the remake first. The remake released on 6606. And
damn you. It's stealing my talking point.
Oh my gosh. That was like the one thing I remember about the remake, and I don't remember really anything else except that heavily marketed release date, because it almost seemed like they were rushing to hit that release date.
Yeah.
Also, I was an edgy teenager. I remember the day The Omen came out and I saw it. I also went and bought AFI's December Underground because that was the release date of that album. Oh, shit. That should have been the musical pairing.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
We got a way better musical pairing, but now that I said that out loud, I'm like, damn it. If we ever cover the remake, spoiler, that will probably be the musical pairing for it. But it was that thing where the remake led me to the original. Madison, what was your
oh my god
experience?
So same. I didn't get to see either of them in theaters, right? But I was really obsessed with the marketing campaign in 2006. I was so excited that a horror movie called The Omen was coming out on 666. Like, I personally thought it was the coolest thing that had ever happened. Mind you, I was 9. So in my little brain, that was the coolest thing that had ever happened.
Wait. Aren't you like a pastor's kid?
Yeah, but I had a metal brother that was into horror.
That's right. I was also
in third grade getting in trouble for wearing shirts that scared the other children at my school and drawing people burning in hell in kindergarten. So I was a little weird.
I love that. Oh my god.
Yeah, I was a full-blown Hot Topic shopper in second grade because my mom is cool. Like, my mom listens to like rock and stuff, and she thought it was cute that I liked emo shit when I was like 7 or 8. Aww, so honey, she didn't care. She was like,
you're like drawing the album cover to Hell Awaits by Slayer. And your mom's like, oh, that's so cute, honey.
No, yeah, my mom thought it was really funny that I like was an alternative child, so they fully funded it. They did not care. I just wasn't allowed to like see movies in theaters like this all the time. I saw some, but like not all the time. This was one where I wasn't allowed to see it in theaters, but I was really obsessed with the concept. And then as soon as I was able to see it at home, I saw it at home. And then that led me to the original. And I was a really big fan. And it's now been a really long time since I'd seen either of them or any of them. But thanks to another remake being made, it kind of brought me back and I'm really excited. So yeah, that's kind of my history with the movie.
Huh. I'm trying to think the exact moment I saw this first one. I think it was one of the years that, like, it might have been the year of release in 2006. I went to I was 13 years old, and it was one of those things of, like, oh, I'm too edgy to go trick-or-treating and whatnot. So I remember going to a friend's, and they just rented, like, a stack of, like, movies from, like, Blockbuster Video. Wow, I'm really aging myself here. Like, there was a bunch of stuff amongst the pile. We had this. We had Exorcist 2, The Heretic, because nobody had seen the second Exorcist. That was interesting that night. And I remember just watching this one and being not necessarily, like, blown away, but just thinking that, oh, yeah, that's a pretty cool movie. I dug that. That child's evil. They wanted to kill that kid. That rules.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I had also rented it. I had a a best friend in middle school that was also really into horror movies, and we would, you know, regularly go to Hollywood Video and rent things, and I remember The Omen being one of them. I think that might have been my first time watching it. I don't really have any memories beforehand. But it had nothing to do with the remake or anything. Like, I have not seen, or at least if I have seen them, I don't remember. But I haven't seen any other sequels or anything in the Omen franchise other than the original and then, like, up until the most recent release. So I was pretty blind to all that, but I just so happened, like, we were kind of like, you know, into going to Hollywood Video, trying to find as many of like the classics we could find, and doing yeah, that every week.
That was a thing, right? Like that experience like doesn't exist for this new generation. I don't think it's the same to go on a streaming service and search for quote unquote the classics. Like it was a different experience walking into the store and like seeing like physical copies of each movie.
Yeah, and I think something also about the fact that, like, you know, if they were rated R and stuff, like, you know, we would have had to have, like, her stepdad, like, there with us to rent, you know, movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, also being that young and you don't have, like, money to do it yeah, yourself, probably, unless, you know, like, you get money to go to the mall or something like that. But, yeah, I don't know, just, and even just stuff that's, like, you know, other than, like, you know, the end of MySpace and like the early Facebook days, it wasn't like I was online hearing a bunch of people talking about a bunch of movies. Like, yeah, you kind of knew about the classics, but it wasn't like, hey, this obscure movie is now on this service. Here's where you can watch it. And here are all these tweets that you can search about it. And so it was like, really obscure stuff we would find. You know, I think it was a little like it felt a little more, I really don't want to use the word magical or anything like that, but it was just so much more like unique than just being like influenced, I guess.
And when you rented something, you committed to watching that. Like, you rented it and you're like, that's my movie for the weekend. Yeah. I have to sit and watch it, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, even like TV, like movie, like a lot of Stephen King stuff was like made into like miniseries almost, or like two-parter things. Like, I remember I have this very specific memory of watching like the Tommyknockers, and it was like, what the fuck is this? You know, like, oh, when no, you're like, you know, it was just like, we just like picked that up, and it was also like, this is so long, and there's like a part one and a part two or something. And, you know, because also like before like Blu-rays and stuff got popular, like you couldn't fit a lot onto one disc, or like,
I remember
my Titanic is like two VHS tapes, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's just, so I think that was also another thing. I think like something about like, this is why I like read physical books too, something about like holding the movie and like opening up the case and like slipping it in, like it's a little more like, whoa, personalized,
sensual,
you know, like rather than just like
made it out
rather than just like scrolling on a service. It's like there's something about like you know, flipping through the aisles and like running your hands across, like being able to read the things on the back, or like who knows what kind of like stuff was in the like little booklets or something. I don't know. It's just like, there's just so much more to the experience, I think.
I'm like emotional right now. Yeah. I'm so nostalgic. That's crazy.
I'm just like, there is this inherent like magical feeling about physical media and the bygone era of the video store. I mean, I feel like I discovered more obscure shit at my video store than online. Like, I don't know, what's an example? Like, stuff like movies like American Gothic. I would have never discovered that if I didn't go to my video store and just, like, randomly see that movie in the horror aisle and go, like, what the hell is this? Like, and also, it was, like, because I was a video store kid, I saw all the Friday the 13th movies in order. Like, my parents owned the VHS of the first one, but then I was, like, Dad, there's like 8 of these. Take me to the store and I'll rent part 2. And then the next week I rented part 3.
Yeah, and we would do stuff like that too. Like, there's a place right down the street. It was like kind of family owned, I think. And they would have, you could do 5 movies for 5 days for $5. And
oh shit.
So there's,
that's a bargain.
Yeah. So there's like 4 of us in the family. So typically it would be like, okay, like each one of you gets a movie, and like mom can pick a movie and dad can pick a movie, and then like my sister and I would like collab on what the fifth movie we would take home as or something. And but then it would be the same thing where like, okay, we're gonna like watch this horror movie, and then like next week we're gonna get like the second one, and then next we're gonna get the third one, and then the fourth one, you know, like. And it was just such a fun little, I mean, yeah, like $5 for 5 days for five movies, and then you could just go do it all again. It was just, I don't know, it was so exciting.
I gotta lay down the law right here that Hollywood Video was better than Blockbuster, because Hollywood Video let you take the movie's art home.
Yeah, I remember, so other than like the more like family-owned place down the street, when I would go like rent things with my friends, it was definitely Hollywood Video, because there was one like pretty close. The Blockbuster was like, you know, a couple exits away, but we could just go down the street to Hollywood Video.
I moved like every 2 years when I was a kid, so it kind of switched every time, but I remember Hollywood Video being more vibey on the inside, like a little darker, and having a little more like merchandise, whereas our like local Blockbusters were a little more sterile, but I loved them both, so.
Oh yeah, you probably, I guess in your areas, you probably had like corporate Blockbusters. I had, like, everyone talks about the difference between corporate and independent Blockbusters, because the corporate ones would be very like sanitized and would edit their movies and whatnot. My Blockbuster didn't. Like, my Blockbuster would carry like Troma and John Waters movies. Like,
I don't know if, I mean, because again, there were multiple different ones. I don't know if they would edit them down at like whatever ones I was going to, but I was also a kid, so I have no idea.
I also, like, this reminds me that I'm like obsessed with finding a certain clock that was hanging in my Blockbuster video. This is like kind of embarrassing, because I've been kind of looking for this clock. I'll find it one day. It was a Batman Forever clock, and it was just like, it was just all black and had like the bat symbol with like the green question mark. And I thought it was the coolest shit ever.
That is pretty cool though. I mean,
that's a rad logo, right?
Yeah. I hope you get it. Yeah. I hope you find this someday. I'm rooting for you.
And I just remember it was always just hung up against like, hung above the cashiers. And it was like, that was the clock they used to like figure out return times and whatnot. And I was like, damn, that clock is cool. I wonder whatever happened to it. Anyway, that's a little off topic. that's a good combo though. So we all discovered the Omens through like various different means, almost universally the video store, because like you said, you didn't have an internet really in these days. It was just kind of word of mouth or you exploring the aisles like for the classics. I mean, I know I was aware of this movie not only because of the remake, but because my parents talked about it. And I think I saw a little clip on Turner Classic Movies one night. But yeah, now here's the actual question. Do you guys even like this movie? Let's just be blunt about it. Like, since you discovered the Omen through various like hoops that we had to jump through as youth, do you guys even like this movie?
So I would say I think it wasn't something that totally impacted me a lot, I guess. There were like a few, there's like the few iconic moments that, you know, but kind of stick with you, but like on a whole, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, I always remember it being something different than what it is. And then when I rewatch it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is a little more like, this isn't like, you know, cause he's like the Antichrist, and like now everything like since, you know, I think since this era, I think like religious horror and anything to do with like the Antichrist and possession is like done so differently. You know, it's not just like some kid and like weird things happen around this kid. Like now it's always like possessions and like whatever, however much like gore you can, you know, put in or something, or, you know, something like that. But yeah, so I kind of forget that it's, I don't want to say slow, but it kind of like unravels in a way that like is different than what we kind of see nowadays all the time. I don't know if that totally made sense.
No, it did. I mean, The Omen, like the first original film that we're talking about, is a very, very, very slow burn. It's probably got to be like one of the few movies that I see from this era that you mentioned, like possession movies and whatnot, and Exorcist came out 3 years before this one. This one takes a little different route. That one, it's got evil manifested in the flesh rather than using somebody else's vessel as a body. Mm-hmm. And two, it plays a lot like a family drama rather than a traditional horror movie. It almost takes like, it's weird because this might be a reach. I could see Hereditary being influenced by The Omen in a way.
Reyna, we're gonna fight after this episode. Not because I disagree, but because I was waiting to make every one of these talking points.
Oh my god. Oh,
no. I'm literally gonna lose it. I'm gonna lose my mind.
I'm gonna jump. I'm gonna
I'm gonna go Omen on them.
No, so do you wanna like take the segue from my points?
Did you see me accidentally turn my camera on? I like jumped when you said it because
I didn't. I got the notes.
Oh my god.
I love that.
So, well, I don't want to just copy everything you said, but my main point for this question was, I don't want to be like offensive to anyone, but I wouldn't consider this a horror movie as much as I would consider it a drama or like a psychological thriller, because there is the question, if you've never seen it before, of are these people all just crazy and they're going to kill this child and he's innocent, or is this really the son of the devil? So there's like a psychological aspect to it where you don't really know for sure, like if it's an unreliable narrator. It also is very much plays out like a drama. The whole first hour and a half just plays like a drama. And it reminded me so much of Hereditary and the pacing and the whole, like, there are outside forces. And I guess like Rosemary's Baby, you know, but like there are outside forces that want your child for something bad, and you have to like figure that out almost. And it is just a really good point, Reyna, and I am on the same page as you 100% as always.
Here's the thing, Madison, I invited you on this show to make unique talking
I'm
points.
So sorry.
Not to copy my own. I don't need an echo. No, I'm kidding.
I thought I had echo cancellation off on my mic.
Oh my gosh, get out of here. Leave the call. No, I'm kidding. No, it's totally that. It's weird because I walk out of Hereditary thinking, oh, that's super inspired by, you know, the family drama. I don't know if you guys have seen it, called Ordinary People. It's not a horror movie at all.
Yeah.
It's just like a very like emotionally devastating family drama. And it's weird because I was rewatching The Omen this week and I was like, oh man, Ari Aster was just sitting here. He was seed ed for The Omen and taking notes. And it's not something I see talked about too much.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? So, like, I guess my relationship, you know, since like my first time watching it, it was one of those things where maybe it was almost like confusion, you know, because of that, like, you know, it's discussed like this like iconic horror movie, but then you're watching it and it's not really that. It's not really horror, like you said. It's the drama. And you know, so after I rewatched it earlier this week, it was really like, I didn't think Hereditary at first, but now that you're saying it, I'm like, oh my god, that, yes. But it made me think like how often we have this like slow burn family drama, like, metaphor for grief, like fatigue with current horror movies. And like people kind of like lamenting, like going back to, like, I just want like blood and stuff. But then it's like, oh, well, everyone's like favorite iconic horror movie is really just a slow burn. And I think I thought that I might have brought that up with The Exorcist too. Like, a lot of these iconic movies are pretty much just like dramas. And so it's interesting that like now all of these movies that are directly influenced by those iconic spooky dramas of the 70s, like now everyone is like, I'm kind of over it. And it's like, this is really the root of the genre in a way. Like, but yeah, I'm going to have to like rewatch Hereditary now with like this fresh in my mind, because I absolutely love Hereditary, but I want to maybe like pay really close attention and like see if I can find more of those seeds in there, because that's a really interesting point.
No, definitely. I think The Omen would pair really well with Hereditary. I think a lot of people go into The Omen with the mindset of like, oh, it's going to be this like crazy satanic movie. And it's really not that. Like you said, Madison, it's almost all like entirely like almost unreliable narrators. It's like, are all these adults just insane that they're going to kill this kid?
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like the subtleties that are what's spooky about it.
Yeah, because you don't know he's the Antichrist until that scene where he goes and looks at his hair while he's sleeping.
Yeah, no, exactly. Where he finds a 666, yeah. And I mean, there's like hints, like when he takes the tricycle to his mom and mm-hmm. and does that. But
even then, is that?
That's true. It could be viewed as an accident.
Like, I've seen worse toddler tantrums, you know, at certain theme parks, you know what I mean? Like, or even just at the grocery store. Like, you know, I see like kids like cussing out their moms and stuff. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, so technically Damien is like pretty innocent in regards to his actual, like his actions throughout the film. It's mostly just the things that are happening around him, which, you know, is obviously like the forces at play because of who he is. But it's not like he does anything particularly evil.
Yeah. And what's so funny about that is two things. Number one, not to sound like a boy mom, because I would never, but he was such a cute kid. I could never kill him if they were like, he's the Antichrist. I'd be like, but he's just a baby. He's so cute. Number one. Number two, I think it's really interesting that they went with that choice of making him seem just like a kid, like a pretty calm, normal kid, because, and I'm sorry for listeners that have had to hear me go on and on about religious shit, but like Christians and Catholics believe that like the Antichrist would be someone that is super charismatic and loved by everyone and handsome and like all these things. So it makes sense that the kid wouldn't be a little demon seed of Chucky. He would be someone that adults like and would grow up, again, in like a very politically powerful home that would be wealthy and grow up to be like this attractive, normal, nice person, because that's what people that believe in that stuff believe the Antichrist to be. So it was actually a really good call for them to make that choice when making the movie, instead of him literally look like a little demon and act like a little demon, you know?
Yeah. And that's almost like the subtlety that is maybe missing from maybe like newer representations of like creepy kids and, or, you know, or other things within like the demonic or religious horror. Like, I think like, you know, kids are put in horror because it's like, oh, they're spooky. But then it's like, then it becomes about like the kid doing something, kids doing weird things, which, I mean, kids do weird things. But yeah, I mean, like, I think from my understanding, like Lucifer or like the angel he was before, it's like, he's like beautiful, like the morning star, you know, it's like, so of course it would be. And even like real life evil, it comes from like charismatic leaders and things like that. So yeah, it's just much more realistic and I guess effective in that way.
No, I completely agree with that. I think that there is, it's hard to walk the line between making a horror movie and keeping that subtlety. And I think that's why this leans less into being a horror movie and more into a drama. And I understand when people are making movies now, you kind of have, you can't pull any punches. You have to go 100% because audiences aren't going to be as willing to sit through a super slow burn, super not scary movie if they're there for horror. But I do think that that's also a fault. And it is really interesting to look back at some slower films from like the 70s and they're really able to just keep the tension there by being so slow. And the horror isn't in like a jump scare or like creepy makeup. The horror is in the situation itself. So I think you're completely right. I think that's such a good point.
Yeah. And like, I think maybe I just differ from, like, you know, like you said, like they kind of have to go 100%. And I, you know, like most audiences, like kind of in a way are demanding that. Or I hear a lot of things, you know, from like maybe general audiences being like, oh, well, that wasn't even really scary. And, you know, having those kinds of sentiments. But like myself as a fan, like I've always loved the more subtle, things like those are what I find actually scary, because, you know, other than spiders, like we have discussed before, like nothing really scares me. So those kinds of, you know, outwardly quote unquote scary things, don't do a lot for me because they're not rooted in any fears that I have. Whereas the real fears you have are the things that don't, like, can't be made with makeup, you know, like the fear of like what your child might be, or the fear that your husband is lying to you about your child. And, you know, like those things have always, you know, those dramatic elements have always been what I find, you know, actually scary about horror films, and why I've always accepted psychological thrillers like into the horror. Like when I talk about horror movies, like I include those things because I'm like, you know, I'm not scared of like monsters and, you know, scary makeup and blood. Like I'm scared of like, I don't know, like loneliness and like existential dread and, you know, like the things that are like lending themselves to drama or to slow burns and things like that. But
totally. One thing I did want to bring up is the religious aspect of this movie. I know I asked this about The Exorcist, but do you guys think it all the religious stuff holds up today at all in this one?
Weirdly enough, because I know that the priest and literally Satan is such a big part of the plot of this film, but I don't feel like it is as necessary as it was in The Exorcist, because this film isn't about like faith or anything like that. And it doesn't feel as big of a part of the movie, which is weird because I know that sounds really counterintuitive to like the whole plot of the movie. But I don't feel like it ages poorly because, I mean, I'm not Catholic, so I don't know what priests are like, but that's just kind of what my idea of priests are like how they look and everything. So it's not like aging poorly for me, but I also don't feel like it's entirely relevant to the plot of this version of The Omen. And so I don't feel like it sways me either way, whereas it's such a big part of some of the other movies we've talked about religion in. So
yeah, like Exorcist is that exploration of faith in that setting. And this one I feel is more about family, if anything.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, like you said, it's like such a huge plot point that like he's literally the Antichrist. So it's like, I feel weird saying that I don't think religion is even like a big aspect of the film. It's just not a big aspect of what I take away from, you know, and other than like a priest being who's kind of like, you know, helping them uncover the truth and the reality about Damien. But, you know, within the actual plot and the actual narrative, it's really like, if you kind of like boil it down, this is all really happening because he didn't tell his wife the truth about their kid dying in the hospital. And it's like,
he lied.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's almost like these, like, you know, this dishonesty was like a seed for, you know, more trauma to come. And, you know, like all of these things that happen, you know, kind of like what we said was part of the reason it's a psychological thriller, is that all of these things are like normal, not normal, but like kind of normal things that could happen to anyone. Anyone could have been a bratty kid who maybe made their mom fall or accidentally witnessed someone committing suicide or something, you know, like anyone could have maybe saw a weird dog growl, you know, like there are like all of these things that like technically could have just been like, this is just about a kid being repeatedly traumatized.
No, seriously.
so it's like really just the family drama and like these subsequent traumas that are all rooted in like this first act of dishonesty, rather than being about, you know, questioning your faith or questioning God or, you know, things like that. It's really just like a big allegory in a way. But then it's like, we all know he is actually the Antichrist. So, I mean, it is technically a big thing, but it's just not big in like what this film does to me, you know?
Yeah, no, that's exactly. You worded it so much better than I ever could have. Absolutely, though.
So, on a lighter note, what is your guys' favorite and or scariest moment in this entire film?
I mean, I have to go with like the nanny death at the birthday party.
Okay.
That's I'm sorry. I feel like that is like kind of like low hanging fruit. It's just so iconic.
I see what you did there with the low
hanging. You know, just it's so ominous, like the it's all for you, and it's just like, you know, coming into the film. You know, I came into the film knowing that he is the Antichrist. Like, that was not unknown to me, like it was to, you know, the first audiences to see this. So when you're seeing that, you're like, dude, what the hell is, like, what is going on, you know? And also, it's just like thinking about how traumatizing that is. Like, literally a bunch of kids, you know, riding a merry-go-round, and they all have to see this.
She ruined like, the vibes just at the function.
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of the vibes I'm bringing.
Me after one party foul, honestly.
Okay.
Me after one minor inconvenience. Yeah.
Can I say this one little thing? This moment gets ruined for me, and especially when I saw it in a theater, when the photographer starts taking photos, like, fast cracked too. Up.
He's speedy with his fingers. Like, it's crazy.
He's like, and I was like,
I mean, I feel he's like a journalist or something, yeah. Right? He's got to get the scoop, like something crazy just went down. It's the same thing nowadays. Anytime something happens, people get their phone
they're
out.
They're live streaming it. Yeah.
They're like live streaming someone dying instead of helping them.
Guys.
It's pretty relevant.
Jordan Peele was onto something with Nope.
No, seriously. Ooh. I have something to say, and it's relevant to your question. So it'll loop back around. I can't talk about the newest version of this film too much. But what I can say is I love so many sequels, requels, prequels. Like I'm not very harsh with it. I love so many. This is one of the first times that I've truly felt like a prequel has not only been good, but enhanced the first film so much. Like I feel like watching The Omen after watching the newest iteration of it, my viewing experience was so enhanced, and specifically that scene, which is also my favorite, of the nanny committing suicide. If you've seen the newest one, there is a similar moment, and I was so pumped rewatching this one and being like, ah, oh my God, like it's just like that. And I felt like it really enhanced this film, which is so hard to do with a classic, especially like if you're making a legacy sequel or a legacy prequel. Like it is so, so hard. And yeah, so that scene was my favorite because not only because it's great, but because I felt like excited to be seeing it, if that makes sense.
Yes, hard agree. Like everything you said, I feel the same way. Like we don't have to get into it, but yeah, it's quite the accomplishment there.
It made the original one relevant again for modern audiences.
Absolutely.
Like people are gonna watch this original Omen and go like, okay, this rules because of that.
Yeah, and I think again, like, you know, I don't want to get into it too much, but there's so much about this film. Like, I enjoyed it so much more on the rewatch than I even think I did, you know, any of the other times in my life that I've watched it, simply because of, like, a new understanding of the lore and, you know, new elements and things like that. So it just, yeah, I think I appreciated it so much more this time around.
I will say, shout out to American Cinematheque and Beyond Fest for showing us a pristine archival 35mm print of the original Omen.
Yeah, it was
so gorgeous. Jealous.
Gorgeous, man,
it was such a good fucking print. That thing looked flawless. Well, they said it was pristine. I guess they said the last time they had shown that print was at the very first Beyond Fest.
No way. Are you serious?
Yep.
That's so cool.
That was the last time that print was shown. And yeah, it looked it. Although there was one moment where the sound cut out. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about, but it's okay. I mean, other than that, like,
It was so crazy to see, like, over half of the audience leave before that one, too.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty late.
But worth it.
It was worth it. It was also a Monday night, you know? I don't know what people
that's
got
true.
going that's on true. Or, like, work the next day.
Well, it just makes it even more special because, like, who knows when that print will be shown again.
Oh, yeah. I definitely agree.
And, I won't say too much. We did see the new one, and apparently we were the first audience ever to see it on that 35mm print. It was the first time they had ever shown that one.
Yeah, so, that was very special.
It was a Grand Omen experience. I love it. I need to take a moment and bring up the director, Richard Donner, who is like a... Well, rest in peace. He's an absolute legend, absolute king shit of a filmography, if I can use that term. Are you guys interested to hear some of the movies he did?
Yeah, let's make this a Donner party. Let's go.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Jesus. Love it.
I'm so sorry.
No. I appreciate the pun. I love it. So he did The Omen in 1976, immediately followed it up in 1978 with a certain film that is also legendary in its own right. Any guesses?
Mm-mm.
He made Superman.
Oh
my God.
That was literally his follow-up film to The Omen, was 1978 Superman. Then in 1980, he was removed from Superman 2, but eventually his cut was released in 2006, which, if you have not seen the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2, that is the version to watch. I don't know. Have you seen that one, Madison?
Sorry, which year?
No, have you seen the Richard Donner version of Superman 2?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay, so that's what he did after Superman, but that version wasn't released until 2006. I'm not naming everything. I'm just naming his big bangers. In 1985, he did a little movie called The Goonies.
Oh, wait, I totally forgot. Oh my God, my king.
In 1987, he had another hit with a film called Lethal Weapon.
Wow. Okay. Iconic.
Good Lord, he's amazing.
In 1988, he did my favorite Christmas film of all time, Scrooged.
Wow. Okay.
Just absolute king shit movies. And in 2006, the year he passed, or like one of his last films before he passed, he did 16 Blocks with Bruce Willis.
Huh. Wow.
Jeez.
I mean...
He also produced the Free Willy movies. He produced the Tales from the Crypt movies and produced the first X-Men film.
Wow. All right. I mean, all iconic, really.
Yeah. The Omen was one of his first films. And it just kind of took off from there.
That's insane.
It's insane because you look at that filmography and he low-key might be one of the most consistent filmmakers to ever live, I think.
Well, damn, he needs more respect on his name for sure.
Well, he did Superman. I don't think superhero movies would exist without that movie.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, I can't argue with that at
all. The Goonies, like one of the most iconic movies of the 80s, Lethal Weapon, like Richard Donner was an absolute king. Like,
yeah, I don't think I know anybody who doesn't quote The Goonies as being like one of their formative, you know, like growing up, it's like kind of coming of age and things like that. Like everyone is like, yeah, The Goonies. Like,
absolutely.
I watched that when I was a kid. So like that's pretty iconic for like most people's lives, really.
His wife is still a producer working in the industry, and she's producing the highly anticipated Deadpool and Wolverine movie coming out later this year.
That's so awesome. I love that she's still working in the industry. Like that's crazy.
Good for her. Like, I love that.
So it's cool. It's great that she's still in the industry. It's sad that Richard Donner passed. Really surprised he didn't direct anything past 2006, even though he passed in 2021. He probably didn't feel the need to make anything else after that.
When you've had such an illustrious career, maybe you're just like, and it's time to rest.
Yeah. The guys who run Beyond Fest were telling a story at the Omen showing that they got to show that archival print of the Omen at the very first Beyond Fest because of Richard Donner.
Oh my gosh.
Richard Donner showed up and did a Q&A, and they were exceedingly like very grateful for him because they're like, Beyond Fest would not be what it is today if it weren't for Richard Donner and his generosity. So
I love that. And I think like myself as a, you know, film goer and like horror fan, like I appreciate like Beyond Fest and American Cinematheque so much for like so many of the cool things we get to see, especially on, you know, projected on 35 and things like that. So it's like, I think so many SoCal, you know, fans don't know that they have a lot to personally thank him for with that.
No, totally. Totally. I mean, he's also was one of the filmmakers involved with American Cinematheque, so... Yeah, that whole...
We're American Cinematheque fans in this household.
Anyway, beside the point, The Omen rules, Richard Donner rules. Glad this movie is kind of in the spotlight again. Definitely give it a watch. Recommend it. As for our musical pairing for this one,
this week we are pairing The Omen with To the Hellfire by Lorna Shore. And for those who don't know, Lorna Shore is an American deathcore band formed in New Jersey in 2009. The group currently consists of the lead guitarist Adam D'Amico, drummer Austin Archie, rhythm guitarist Andrew O'Connor, and vocalist Will Ramos, and the bassist Michael Yeager. And the band is most known for this 2021 single, To the Hellfire. And I Return to Nothingness is the fourth EP by the band, and it was released on August 13th, 2021 through Century Media Records. And the EP is their first release featuring the new vocalist, Will Ramos, as well as rhythm guitarist Andrew O'Connor, who joined just prior to the release of their previous album, Immortal. And To the Hellfire became a viral success for the band, peaking at number one on the iTunes metal chart in its first week of release. It would also go on to overtake Immortal as the band's most streamed song on Spotify at over 4 million streams. It was elected by Loudwire as the best metal song of 2021.
Okay. 4 million is a lot of streams for a song like this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure this is pretty, like, this has a lot to do with TikTok. To the Hellfire got really popular as a—
Are you joking? Is it a TikTok song?
It was all over my For You page. I think a lot of people found Lorna Shore partially because of TikTok. It was used as a sound. It was like viral to like reacting to like the infamous like pig squealing at the end. There's like this really young vocalist. He's like young, like 10 years old. There's like him doing this song at karaoke that went viral on TikTok, to, you know, and him also doing like Motionless and White songs and things, like, to the point where he has now actually like been invited on stage at one of their tours. So yeah, like it kind of went viral on TikTok a bit. Yeah.
I almost said the Euphoria quote of like, bitch, you better be joking.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to say I hate that, like, to be all like, like, boo TikTok, but it, you know, and a lot of people in certain scenes have a lot of feelings about getting an influx of fans coming from TikTok because, like, there's been issues with, like, etiquette, like pit etiquette and things like that.
Oh,
now.
My god.
Yeah. but I do think it's really great for the band, especially given you know, like, I we made a point of saying like it currently consists of, and a few of the members are new after Immortal. Like, I think it's really great that they went viral with the beautiful man that is Will Ramos, given their really rocky history with previous members of the band. So, you know, however people feel about TikTok, I think it's really great that like they're getting to shine now
with this lineup. And you know, Will Ramos is like a golden retriever of a personality too. He just seems
the sweetest man ever.
Which you would not think that hearing this song in particular.
Yeah, I think it makes being a fan of them like so much more enjoyable now.
Madison, you had not heard this song at all before this, had you?
I don't think so, but I have heard of this band.
Uh-huh.
And but so, I think this was my first time like fully listening to the song.
And what are your thoughts?
I really liked it. Oh my God. I know that now I'm just making points that TikTok made, but I texted you guys about this. The pig squeals went off. They're so good. I think lyrically it really matched up with like our subject matter for today. Mm-hmm. And it was really good. This is another one that like I would add to a playlist. I really liked it.
Okay. Tangent, you need to listen to the album that they put out after this EP called Pain Remains.
Wait, I feel like I've heard of that, actually.
You might have heard of it maybe because of me.
That makes sense. That checks out.
Yeah, it's amazing. And like, you know, this release is really important because it's technically their like debut of Will as their vocalist. Like he joined them on tour. The previous album was recorded with their old vocalist, but they had parted ways before they were able to actually tour that album. So he was like invited as a guest to perform during the tour, but then this was like their actual like, hey, this is our guy now. Like, this is us. This is our new identity. Like, this is our new sound. But then, like, they actually were able to fully develop, like, an amazing, amazing album with Pain Remains. Like, I listen to it, like, constantly. It's almost a problem now.
The last song, Pain Remains, is split up into three parts as, like, a finale to that album. I struggle to listen to that section of the album without like bawling by the end of it.
It's so good. And I've literally seen, because there's that lyric, like now I finally see a world without you isn't meant for me. And I've literally seen people getting proposed to like on their tour
so
during that lyric. And it's just, yeah, it's iconic. And yeah, it's just, it's so beautiful. And I am just so happy they have Will now. Like, I mean, there's maybe a couple songs that I maybe enjoyed before, but like it wasn't worth, you know, being a fan of them with that previous vocalist. So it's just, they're just so much better now.
Well, with the EP that this is from, and I Return to Nothingness, I think what really made them stand out is they kind of moved away from the deathcore sound of the previous albums, and they really started to lean into like almost a black metal sound, very like doom-esque. We got like symphony strings in the background of our songs, less like blast beats and whatnot, more like symphonic stuff, if it makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that really, that definitely then is even expanded upon with Pain Remains also. But
oh,
yeah,
totally.
It just makes it more dynamic. And I think like it helps them stand out a little bit, like not just from who they were before, like trying to have their own identity. Like I remember when it was like you couldn't say you liked Lorna Shore because then people would think you're problematic kind of thing. So it's like really nice that they can really fully have like their own, like they still have the same name, but like no one, you know, no one like blinks an eye now because they have just their own unique, you know, like you said, they're leaning into a little bit of a different sound and it makes them just more interesting.
They're breaking through to like mainstream audiences and taste too as well, which is like very rare for a band of like this type of caliber. I do want to circle back to that point, Madison, that you thought this was a perfect pairing. Like, I want to elaborate a little more on that. Like, how do you think it ties into the Omen for you personally?
Yeah, totally. I mean, just a lot of the lyrics, like the repeating of "swallowed by the womb of death" is really fitting for a movie where a child was carried to like be the Antichrist.
Yes.
I really liked, sorry, there was another lyric I noted that I really liked. Oh, yeah. The accepting this damnation, relinquish flesh temptation of the body and the soul. Like that whole, it just feels really fitting to what the movie is and like more the future of Damien almost. Like what Damien could be in the future.
Yeah.
I really liked it. It felt very fitting for that.
Yeah. Like just in that same, you know, it says like release your grip and face the tide, accepting this damnation. Like it is kind of like, that's what's happening here. Like the, you know, they're trying to figure out what's going on, but like given who he is and his, like, I guess destiny, it's like, there's nothing you can do. You just have to like accept it.
I also like the line, free me from this mortal shell, because it's like it's evil. It's the devil trapped in a kid's body. Like that's not like his true form. Like we all know from this film that it's like the jackal, like,
yeah,
like this beast that isn't human. Like free me from this mortal shell, get me out of this kid and human body, like let me free to like run amok.
Yeah. And like I don't know, there's also like I almost want to say, like, we'll probably get into it on a separate, you know, at another time, but it also, like we were saying, watching the recent release gave us a little bit more appreciation. Like I think also some of my appreciation of these lyrics and their connection like have to do with that too. But yeah, like I don't know, there's like, your mind is dissolving light, enter the void and fall with me. Like thinking about like fall with me, because that's, you know, the Antichrist is coming and is going, like these, the nanny literally, fall with me, like she's falling, you know, like
yeah
like totally. All for him. So it kind of has this like, you have to follow me and you have to give yourself over to me. It's just very, very fitting.
I also like how the song brings up Azrael, and Azrael in the Bible is the angel of death. Mm-hmm. One of the angels that's going to be on the front line in that final war against the Antichrist and the forces of evil.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's perfect. At first, like I know we've been on like a Lorna Shore kick. So I was like, I know we just want to talk about them at some point.
I know.
So when we, you know, brought it up as the pairing, but then when I like was actually looking at the lyrics and everything, I was like, oh no, yeah, this actually is perfect.
Yeah. You know, every time we discuss what we should do for a musical pairing, my gut check is always like Whitechapel or Lorna Shore. But like this week, I was like, no, wait, we really could do Lorna Shore this week for this.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's actually perfect.
No, so good. Such a great fucking band, if I'm being real. Like, kind of, it felt like a pump to the veins. Like hearing them for the first time and going like, oh wow, this genre can still be great. Like this, it's barrier shattering. Mm-hmm. I know people that listen to this band that like don't like deathcore or like death metal or anything, but are just like fascinated with like this EP and the album Pain Remains.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, a lot of that has to do with Will also being, he's very, like active online and things like that. He is very responsive. Like I always see him in the comment sections of people who are like doing covers of his vocals and things like that. So he's very like supportive and like he loves like the fans, and you know, and even that like kind of collab I guess he did with Charismatic Voice, that's probably what put this band into like more of a like a broader scope, like people who had never heard of them probably.
Tell Madison about that video.
Yeah, so I think it started with a Charismatic Voice, like from what I understand, like she does like vocal training and those kinds of YouTube videos. She also does a lot of reaction videos, like listening to certain songs and like maybe kind of analyzing what they're doing with their voice.
Is she on TikTok?
Yeah, so she...
Then, yeah, I know who that is. Totally.
Yeah,
totally.
So she does, like, her YouTube, and then, like, a lot of it gets posted to TikTok. She did, it was probably, it might have been this song, even, reacting to Will's vocals. And then she had him on her channel and, like, took him to this place that does, like, research on vocal cords. And they totally stuck a camera down his throat so they could watch what his throat and like larynx and like what his anatomy is doing while he's making these different sounds. And like the people who like worked at the research center, it was like at some university, like they were like, this is amazing. I've never seen someone's like body do this before. And it just kind of shed a little bit of light on like some of the misconceptions I think of this type of vocal work. Like,
yeah,
there's the idea that it's like damaging, and I mean there are plenty of people who probably started off not learning techniques and did damage like themselves, but yeah, it was just like a whole new appreciation. And then because she has such a wide audience and like of people who probably would not have listened to this music, I think it really like, yeah, and also seeing what a sweet human he is, I think it just really broadened, you know, the eyes that are on Lorna Shore.
That's so cool. That makes me want to listen to them even more. Love that.
Do it. Listen to Pain Remains.
Yeah.
Don't even question it. Just listen so to good. The album start to finish.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Definitely. Any final comments or questions or anything about The Omen or Lorna Shore of any kind?
No, this was just a super fun combo. It was a great choice. Whoever picked the music, that was a really good call.
That was me.
Yep, Raina. Raina has been coming in clutch with these music pairings.
It's It's just stuff that's on my daily rotation.
No, yeah, it's just, I think what's also funny to think is that like there's this idea that like obviously very like outdated like 70s satanic panic player record backwards, like there's this idea that like metal and like this kind of music, because it sounds a certain way, is blasphemous or demonic or something like that. But it's actually quite hard to find music that has quite blasphemous lyrics. I mean, there's a lot of like maybe questioning religion as an institution, like, and questioning authority, especially in like the more punk like genres, but like straight up like talking about like hellfire and damnation, and it's not as common as people might think. You know, when I was going through like my library of heavy music to like pair with these iconic demonic films, you know?
it's tough. A lot of like demonic blasphemous music that I find, well, aside from the choices that I do find, a lot of them just end up being like Norwegian black metal, like edgy for the sake of edginess.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
I want to find stuff with like a little bit more depth, and which is why I chose this and last week Born of Osiris. So yeah, no, the good stuff is out there. Just gotta know where to look. With that being said, Madison, where can people find you on social media?
Hello. So you can find me on Twitter at Final Girl Mads, everywhere else at Madison Gracie _. And you can listen to Raina and I talk about slasher films at Slasher Girls Pod. Our podcast is on a hiatus at the moment, but we will be back really soon with new episodes.
Vanna, where can people find you on socials?
You can find me pretty much anywhere at SirenDeathCult.com. Not .com. I haven't been posting to my blog in a while, but if you want to go there, you can. Maybe I'll make some posts. We'll see. You can also find some video essays on Joe Blow's Horror Network on YouTube. And Reyna, where can people find you?
You can find me on all social medias at JFC Doomblade. That's X, Instagram. I can't believe I refer to it as X. I meant Twitter. Blue Sky, Letterboxd. If there's a JFC Doomblade, it's me. And you can follow the pod at CarnalEXPod on Twitter and Instagram. We'll have another spoiler episode coming up, and it's for a certain movie that I won't say, but I'm very excited to talk about that. But yeah, join us next week. Until then, this is Carnal Extremities signing off.